I'm going to offer a sermon I wrote early last week, even though it may now sound a bit out of sync with our latest reality. I'm counting on my basic optimism to believe that all will be well and all will be well and all manner of thing will be well, as Julian of Norwich once told us. It is the hope of the world. I earnestly advise us all to hold it in our hearts and in our minds at present. Today's readings offer a wonderful cross-section of lessons that encourage and restore us. The prophet Isaiah promises vindication and beauty, promising a new name and a crown of beauty. The hearers of these words were no longer to be considered forsaken or desolate. The great Lord of all, says the prophet, will be to Israel as a bridegroom toward his bride. These are powerful promises for a people who feel abandoned or overwhelmed by conflict, and the people who hear these promises seem to reply in the psalm, "Your love, O Lord, reaches to the heavens. Your righteousness is like the strong mountains. Your justice like the great deep. And you, in you is the well of life. And in your light, we see light." The reassurances of God's favor must have given those who heard these songs new will and new faith, a new hope. In any new undertaking or in any return to a long-awaited process, the affirmation of hope and favor and success is what keeps us humans going. And as we learn elsewhere, the greatest gift is love. We understand that there are many forms and many areas of human endeavor and interaction that can be linked to the blessings of love. We feel the bond of love here in our family of worship, in our children, in the lives of men and women whom we admire, although we may not have a personal relationship with them. And we feel the love of creation and of the Creator. And we understand how much we may instinctively feel that the love of God is the foundation of all the various forms of love. Our creation is a miracle. Even scientists might say so. And we are each of us blessed with different ideas and skills and capabilities, just as were the citizens of Corinth to whom Paul addressed his letters, or of our own encounters with other followers of the Christ. A decade or so ago, Joe and I visited Corinth with a Greek friend. I walked up the road from the little cafe where we'd lunched to peer through a chain-link fence toward the old ruined city. Nobody else was around, either inside or outside the fence. I didn't really feel the need to enter the ruins, but I wanted to walk along the dirt path and think about who had been there and what they had been told by Paul and what gifts I too might have, just as Paul assured. He had said, "To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good." Our culture has degraded the term common, but here it means what it actually says, that we hold these gifts together. They are not owned by one or by one group, but it is a communal gift and for the community. It's a reminder of our need to share and to value what others share with us. But of course, the reading from today's gospel is probably what most of us will remember. It's the story known and referred to far beyond any pulpit or indeed any church gathering. For in it have been grounded many ideas and myths about what may or may not even be part of the actual text we heard today. First of all, it seems to validate the almost universal notion that a wedding requires communal gathering, and also underscores that the witnesses of the occasion will be entertained, at least fed, as well as share a significant event in the life of a friend or family member. Even the simplest service has some celebratory moments. In our culture, the majority of weddings includes a religious component. People get married in a church or a synagogue, or at least have an official of a religious affiliation as the person who leads the public question and answer session. Do you? Will you? Have you? In the U.S., the great majority of weddings are held in places of worship. And the two components, the legal and the religious, are combined and usually administered by the same person. In our prayer book, you will see an opening section in the marriage service that actually is in service to the state, the legal part. Then there's a longer section of commitment in the name and presence of the spiritual power. As far as the law is concerned, that first part's sufficient. It entitles you to be considered married. Even in our time, when a one-day license can create a surrogate official who acts on behalf of the state of California, such divisions are common. In Roman Catholic countries, couples and a few witnesses enter the courthouse or the equivalent of it and offer a few sentences of legal pledges and sign some papers, and then they dash across the piazza to the cathedral where their friends and their family are waiting amid flowers and music and food for the blessing of the marriage. As a tourist, I've been witness to several of these piazza throngs on their giddy way to church. Most Americans combine the two events seamlessly. I do know one Episcopal priest who refuses to do the state's work and would only offer the couple the blessing part of the ceremony. And we all know many young couples now who just pick out a beloved uncle or cousin or friend to be legally licensed for the day to perform the ceremony, including, I've observed, his or her own invented kind of blessing statement. In Jesus' time, the reception is obviously a very important piece of the celebration. We know nothing of the legal part of the joining. It's not the marriage that is the focus of this story. But the reception, which lasts for several days. There are no ceremony, no signing of anything, no mention of the bride, only of the groom, and that only in terms of his failed party planning. But Jesus' mother understands the customs and knows this running out of wine is a serious matter for the young bridegroom. So she tells her son, who has just begun the process of gathering together a small band of men to hear his teachings and to hear him spread the good news. Note that Jesus and his recently acquired students or followers have arrived at the wedding separately from Mary. But when the host family is about to be put to shame for running out of refreshments, Mother steps in. She must already have a good idea of what her son is capable of, for she simply informs the hosts that have run out of wine. And Jesus' response to her is actually a bit testy. Note, he doesn't say, "What's that to me?" He says, "What's that to you and me?" In other words, this is some other family's problem. And I like the way Mary responds. She doesn't answer her son at all, but addresses the bridegroom's servants. "Do whatever he tells you." Obviously nodding toward her son. And although Jesus seems reluctant to display publicly the powers he possesses, he obeys his mother and solves the problem by turning a huge quantity of water into a huge quantity of very good wine. This episode is very famous. It's been used to demonstrate that Jesus approved of marriage, though as far as we know, he never married. It has been used to show that drinking wine is not a thing Christians need to avoid, but that can be troublesome, obviously, for some believers. And it shows that his powers were not limited to huge dramatic events like walking on water or calming the storm or raising a friend from the tomb. John ends this episode there. He's careful to tag on what is almost a footnote to the story so that we understand that it is a miracle. Jesus' first miracle, that it was a particular town, Cana, and that it cemented the faith of those followers who were or became his disciples. And of course, it ties in forever for Christians that it is wine that becomes his own blood in the Eucharist, the reminder of his own death and resurrection. For his followers, the wine was to become the linking act. In Cana, he says to his mother, my hour has not yet come. But for Christians, while sharing this story of joyous beginnings which a marriage offers, we hold in our hearts too all that occurs when his time does come. And the wine of the Eucharist and the blood of Christ are one. Although we've been living in a time of unnatural isolation that doesn't feel right, we must keep in our hearts that we are together, that we rejoice. It seems fitting to end the story with John's prophetic words that the act revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. Amen.